My brother, I am sure now that you were right about Jesus. Thank you for taking me along to see him in the temple and to hear him speak these last 3 days.
I am more sure now than I have ever been. He is the prophet of God, the Messiah. He teaches the wisdom of God and nothing else. He has healed the sick and the lame in every place that he goes. My sister lives because of him.
I know. We have seen the way the Pharisees treat him and speak of him. And we have watched the people turn away from him because of the elders. I have been reading in Isaiah and God's promise concerning his holy servant. It says, he has no stately form or splendor, and when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. Does that fit Jesus? Now listen to this. He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. This is exactly what the elders and the people are doing. They despise him.
This is God's word, and it has been weighing heavy on my heart. Isaiah assures us that the Messiah will be wounded, bruised, and chastised. We are healed by the stripes that are laid upon him? How can that be?
I don't know. The power of Rome is far too great, and there is no conceivable way that anyone can redeem Israel at this time. This is too much to bear. I believe him, but I am fearful.
God is moving, and he is surely moving through this man. We need to be as close to Jesus as we can, but try to do it without being noticed. He truly is the center of it all.
Hello and welcome to the Common Sense Gospel. I'm Danny Simmons.
And I'm Kurt Norbit.
And we have been listening together. We've been listening to these two men as they work together and try to figure out who Jesus really is. It's interesting to hear them kind of go through this because like many of the Jews in the Bible, they're looking at Jesus, then they're looking at Scripture, then they're looking at Jesus again, and they're saying, this has to be the one who God promised was come. He has to be the one. Meanwhile, the elders, the Pharisees, the scribes, and the Sadducees, they're determined to prove that he's an imposter. And this is the biggest problem for those who think that Jesus is the Christ. And isn't that right? Even some in the council believed or were leaning toward believing, but they were so adamant as a group that he cannot be, that he would tear away their position and that Rome would crush them if they allowed Jesus to keep teaching the way he was. That there was a lot of reason for them to be concerned and to just back away from it.
Yeah, there was some, I think, some turmoil going on within the Sanhedrin. We know from early on, according to the words of Nicodemus, when he came to Jesus by night in John 3, he said, "We know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these things that you do unless God's with him." So we know. So already there were some among the Sanhedrin who were recognizing Jesus. John tells us that even among the priests, many believed on him, but they wouldn't confess him for fear of the Jews. So there's that inner turmoil not happening just within the individual, the turmoil. But here's this discussion going on within the Sanhedrin. And it tells us later on that Nicodemus did not consent to their deed. So he apparently was part of the debate on what they wanted to do with Jesus, how they were going to get it done, and he did not agree. And he was someone who carried some weight, apparently, in the council.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't a unanimous effort on the part of the Sanhedrin. There were those, even among them, who we would consider to be among the remnant, who looked upon Jesus and said, he's got to be the one.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a lot happening as we've tried to lay out and show to all of us as we go through this together that, you know, it's one thing for us to look at these moments and go, what's their problem? But that's what we're trying to offer as we move through this, is this balanced approach that some see it, some are concerned, some have worries that they share and that God puts down on paper for us to know and to understand. And the Pharisees, the scribes, the Sadducees, the elders of the people, they are not even convinced of one way or the other. There's too many powerful signs, like Nicodemus pointed out, that Christ is done. Those cannot be denied. And Nicodemus does carry a lot of weight with anything he says, because in John 3, Jesus says to him, "Are you not the teacher of Israel?" That is high praise coming from Jesus. He calls him the teacher of Israel. So to be able to sit and to study with Nicodemus would be a great privilege and an honor for any Jew. And he sees something special in Jesus And again, that just infuriates the group that now we got somebody who's a big dog, you know, here with us, and he's starting to drift, and, you know, that's going to cause problems. And so Annas and Caiaphas, playing the role of high priest, they're going to try to redirect all of this. And so that brings us, as we've moved through this series together, that brings us to Judas Iscariot. Mark chapter 14 and verse 10. Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad, and they promised to give him money. So he sought how he might conveniently betray him. And so now we were talking about, what will the council do? They don't like Jesus. They're afraid of the crowd. The crowd's afraid of the council. There's all these moving pieces. And now all of a sudden, here he is.
Yeah. It's, you can imagine the wrestling that the council was doing here, because now they have firmly made the decision. We need to get a hold of him and kill him. We've got to get him out of the scene here. It's causing too much trouble. But as we've seen all through this, they keep being faced with dilemmas. They're in a quandary. Okay, how do we do it? Who knows how long they wrestled over that. They're just looking, got to get a way to get this guy. But we've got to keep the people from getting riled up. We don't want the Romans getting involved, because if the people do get all fired up about this, they're going to come and quell things. So how do we do this quietly? And there doesn't seem to be any solution until it's dropped right in their lap. One of Jesus' own disciples suddenly shows up and says, "What will you give me? And I will deliver him to you." So now someone comes in front of them, willing to sell him out. And I think, as you just read, it's important to see they were glad. Here's the solution to our problem. Here's what we've been wrestling with. This weight is off our shoulders. Now we can get it done. And it'll be done in a way where now we don't have to worry about the crowd.
Yeah.
Because this guy knows his movements. This guy's familiar with his pattern. He'll get him to us in a way that won't be a threat.
That's right. He's an inside guy, and now we have what we need. And I think even in this brief exchange that we see, that we can see the shallow nature of Judas. Because in Matthew's account, it says that Judas went to the chief priest and said, "What are you willing to give me to betray him to you?" It says they weighed out 30 pieces of silver. And from the study I've done, it's basically the payment for a male slave, 30 pieces of silver. It's pretty pathetic as far as its total amount, especially when we're talking about the Son of God. It's embarrassing to the highest degree. But you can almost see that these men, as badly as they need him and as badly as they need him to fulfill this role, they give him scraps, which I think they can see the baseness of who he is, that he's willing to turn in his own master. So he'll take anything. Don't you see that? They didn't offer, there was no barter. He's like, "No, hold on a second. Yeah. You need him and I've got a way, you know, you better give me more." There's no discussion. He's just like, "Okay."
Yeah, I've often thought of that, because when you look at Judas, we often look at him and we wonder, how could he do this? Here's a person who he was chosen as an apostle by Jesus himself. We're not told any of the circumstances surrounding his calling, as we are with some of the others where Jesus would say, "Follow me." So we don't know when and where Jesus came across Judas. But Jesus knew what he was doing when he picked Judas, because we're told that he was essentially a dishonest man. John 12 tells us that he kept the money bag for the apostles, but he stole from it. So this man is a thief. He's self-seeking. He loves money, because he's willing to steal from the treasury, the apostles' treasury. And we know what Paul tells us about loving money. It's the root of all kinds of evil. Jesus warns us that we can't serve God and mammon, or material things, money. And so when I look at that, I think it helps answer for us, how could Judas do this? Because I would assert that from the very beginning, Judas was betraying Jesus.
Yeah.
He already was. for some reason, even after 3 years of seeing Jesus, knowing the thoughts of people, being able to read their hearts, being able to get right to the heart of a problem, he thinks he's getting away with something when he's stealing a few pennies, you know, every day, whatever it was he was taking. I'm sure they didn't have a lot of money, but he's robbing the till and thinking that he's got something going here. Jesus knew about this all the way through. He knew who Judas was, that he had the character that would allow him to be capable of such a heinous act, of committing the greatest betrayal in the history of mankind. And yet Jesus chose him for that. So it's not that the devil grabbed a hold of Judas and made him do it. None of that. Judas had a choice, and he made the choice early on.
Yeah.
He's a thief. So he's a hypocrite all the way through the ministry of Jesus. And Jesus knows it. So it should really not be surprising that when push comes to shove, Judas is capable of doing this.
Yeah.
Because he was that kind of person anyway.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. A lot of times, even for me personally, I've looked at Judas, and you know, even if someone says, well, can you present something on Judas? What was it, choice? Did the devil make him? Whatever it is, those questions do come up. It comes up in our own study. And I've looked at it closely many times, and I've wondered about it. And I'm trying to get into his mind. And the Bible doesn't give us enough to do that, not appropriately or effectively. But you've mentioned all the things that we do know about him and why we can draw some conclusions concerning him. And the fact that, you know, he was to watch over the treasury. He had the money box that was for all the disciples and for Jesus. That's found in John chapter 12. And in John, we'll just look at this because we believe, if you're looking at Judas in a character study, that this has to be part of that study. And let me just read through it, and we'll see here what's taking place and how Judas reacts to it. John 12 and verse 1, then 6 days before the Passover. So we've backed up a little bit in time from our last episode. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus was. Lazarus is the one who Jesus raised from the dead. It says he had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him. Then Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard, anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the money box, and he used to take what was put in it. But Jesus said, "Let her alone. She has kept this for the day of my burial. For the poor you have with you always, but me you do not have always." We have this awesome moment in time where somehow Mary has the intuition, some kind of understanding that it's, we're close, we're getting close. This spikenard is used just for these reasons. I think wedding ceremonies, spikenard would be brought out and used for the bride and occasions such as that. Certainly the burial, being anointed for a burial, because when someone dies, they don't smell too good.
No.
And spikenard is such a glorious ointment to have to cover some of that as they go mm-hmm. through the funeral procession and all those things. And Jesus says, "She has saved this for my burial." Judas gives us the total of what it's worth. 300 denarii is about a year's wages, from what I understand. You work for a full year to get what was in that bottle. And it says she just broke it wide open and used every bit of it on Jesus. And now Judas is watching this, and he says, "Why did she waste all that?"
Yeah, the first thing he sees is money. So it fits his character. His thought is, 300 denarii, that could have made me rich. You know, a whole year's wages that I could dip into.
No, he wanted to give it to the poor.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he's such a sterling character.
Yeah.
But Jesus' rebuke is, I think, important here too. And I like how you read that, because I feel like. And of course, we weren't there. We didn't get to hear the way Jesus said it. We didn't get to see the facial expressions or anything. But I don't think that this was just a soft response from Jesus, like, oh, let her alone. She's just doing this for me. I think Jesus was a bit upset with this. Let her alone. She's doing this for my burial. And that may be something that set Judas off. We don't know. And really, when we do a lot of discussion and thinking of what motivated Judas, you know, here's this last week, what was it that made him decide I'm gonna betray Jesus? What made him think about going to the priests and selling Jesus out? Well, we don't know.
No.
God has not revealed that in his word, therefore it's not relevant. The fact is, he was a thief. He had an ungodly character. He was a hypocrite, a liar, thought only of himself. And so he went and did this. What motivated him? What was the trigger? It doesn't matter. This man turned Jesus in for 30 lousy pieces of silver. And like you said, here's the chance for him to really get rich. He could have said, 30, what is this? I want 3,000. You know, I'm doing something here for you. Let's make it worth my while. He was satisfied with the price of a slave. And of course, that fulfilled prophecy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That prophecy is tied directly to that. And Jesus, as he responds to this situation, he says in Matthew's account, after he says, leave her alone, he says in verse 13 of Matthew 26, assuredly, I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her. So it's even more emphatic where he's really telling Judas, shut your mouth. Mm. This will be preached in the gospel throughout the whole world. As long as the gospel is brought up, what she has done will be mentioned. And here we are talking about the gospel.
Yep.
And here, yep. And she is right in front
mentioned.
Of us.
Yep.
And I love the phrase that the fragrance filled the whole house. Mm. Someone who's devoted their life to Jesus, that fragrance will fill their home, won't it?
Yeah, just show. I love that picture too. Jesus and what is done for him just permeates the atmosphere. Everybody notices it.
Exactly.
So it is a beautiful word picture.
Exactly. That is such a great thing. Yeah, so we know now that Judas is a thief and he's been taking money out of the money box. And we also know that Jesus knows that in this moment in time. And I think that also kind of, you know, we're saying to each other, we can't go any further than what the Bible says, but we want to so bad. Mm-hmm. It's like all of these pieces are here, and we know that Jesus knows men's hearts. He knows all things. He already knows that God has given all power into his hands and all authority. And he's still going to talk to Judas. Judas is necessary. I'm thinking about Jesus when he rebukes Peter and says, you know, get behind me, Satan. You're mindful of the things of men and not of the kingdom of heaven or not the things of God. And Peter must have been like, well, what are you talking about? I don't want you to die. That's all I was saying. But Judas is also mindful of the things of men, and yet he needs to stay right where he is. Jesus is not going to run him off. Jesus is not going to point at him and tell the other men he's been stealing because he's necessary.
Yep.
So that's why Jesus can continue to talk to him and continue to reach out to him, to offer that olive branch in the conversations they have, in the royal right that he's granted Judas to heal people of sickness and to cast out demons. I believe that he can do that because he's necessary for God's will to be fulfilled. And in that, Jesus can say, okay, this is part of it, and you're with us. But man, what amount of faith and courage does that take to hold back all of the angry things you want to say to someone.
Yeah, you look at, chosen as an apostle, spends 3 years with Jesus, and Jesus knows every second of the day, this is the one who's going to betray me. This man is an enemy. But like you said, he continues, there's no indication throughout his ministry that he treated Judas any different than any of the other apostles. He had the full privileges and responsibility of an apostle. But Jesus knew in his heart, every time this guy opened his mouth, Jesus is reminded, this is the one.
That's right.
But he, as you said, he is an important part of the story. Jesus is going to have to be betrayed. Isaiah prophesied that.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus chose Judas for that. When he saw him, he says, you're the one because I know you're capable of doing it. And I need to pick you.
Hmm.
And so he always is set apart whenever you read about the other apostles, because it will identify Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. So it's just, it's a mind-boggling thing, really. But one thing I do to account for it is what I like to call it, think of the insanity of sin. When you get locked into sin, when sin has a hold on you, and it already did on Judas, as we've noticed, you just don't think right. You don't make correct decisions. You don't come to the right conclusions because you're thinking about me.
Yeah.
It's all about me. And the decisions you make are going to be corrupted by that viewpoint. And so when we look at any of this, as we look at the Jewish council and how they treated Jesus, how could they do that? They were insane because they were in sin.
Yeah.
Sin had taken over their thoughts, and so they just did not think rationally. And obviously you can see that.
That's exactly right. And that is such a great point from this. You've said it several times, but all of the lesser acts of dishonesty have hardened his conscience, mm-hmm. which allowed him to engage in a much more shameful act without hesitation. That's how you get there. And so that warning is there for all of us. It's like, well, this is just a little thing, and no one will know. And I need this for me. You know, that's not how we should look at things. We should always look at it as, does God approve? Whatever I say and whatever I do, can I say that it's being done in the name of the Lord? Colossians 3:17, whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. To me, that's the greatest safeguard as to where my actions are leading me. And as you said, those little bitty sins, just taking a little money out of the money box, no big deal. Nobody notices. Everyone's still eating, you know, no problem. Yes, there is a problem. The problem is you've compromised what you know to be right and true for your own benefit. And those smaller acts of dishonesty made it a perfect opportunity.
Yep.
Just do it again.
They all add up. Those little sins, that every time one is committed, it hardens your heart that much more.
That's very sad.
Until when we reach this point, he is able to commit this heinous sin.
That's right. And that's why we have to be careful of it all of the time. So if you look at every gospel, when they talk about Judas going to betray and going to these chief priests and the Pharisees, and that's really all that we're looking at, this moment of time when the door is opened for these wicked men, it always says of Judas, one of the 12. Every gospel writer makes sure that we understand that he was with them from the beginning. And Luke gives us the best explanation of what Judas actually did, what the chief priests and the scribes were thinking, and the details of the arrangement that Judas made with them. And so Luke 22 says, now the feast of unleavened bread, which is called the Passover, it was approaching. The chief priests and the scribes were seeking how they might put him to death, for they were afraid of the people. And Satan entered into Judas, who was called Iscariot, belonging to the number of the 12. And he went away and discussed with the chief priest and the officers how he might betray him to them. They were glad and agreed to give him money. So he consented and began seeking a good opportunity to betray him to them apart from the crowd. That tells us everything.
Yep. It tells us the Jewish council's response. It gives us Judas's thinking. And it also shows us that lapse in time. He didn't just go out and betray Jesus right away. He sought an opportunity. And we're told when that opportunity rose. During the Last Supper, after Jesus instituted or observed the Passover with his apostles and Judas there, he made the sorrowful statement, one of you is going to betray me. And of course, they're All but one of them are astonished to hear that. And they're asking him, well, is it me, Lord? Is it I? Am I the one? And it finally comes to Judas. And being the scoundrel that he is, Lord, well, he doesn't even call him Lord. Nope. Significantly, he says Rabbi. So by this time, he has now disowned Jesus as his Lord. He's just the teacher.
Exactly.
And that's, there we see again the evolution of his thinking and his attitude toward Jesus. You're not my Lord anymore. And so he says, Rabbi, is it I? And he says, you have said it. Mm. So he agrees. And then probably almost immediately after, we don't know the exact timing of the things that took place, the intervals between, but he says, what you do, do quickly. And Judas leaves. From that point on, of course, Jesus institutes the Lord's Supper. Now that the traitor's gone, with his faithful disciples, he institutes his memorial meal. And then they depart from the place and go into the Garden of Gethsemane. At that point, in my view, Jesus is alone. Because he takes his disciples with him into the garden. Then he goes into another quieter place in the garden and takes Peter and James and John with him and tells them, watch here while I go over there and pray. So Jesus is by himself and pours out his heart to God, because now he knows what's coming. Judas is very possibly on his way from the temple to the garden now, because he knows where it is, and he knows Jesus must frequent that place. So here's the opportune time. Jesus prays. We see the turmoil, the torment in his spirit, the agony that he goes through, Luke telling us that he shed great drops, as it were, of blood, goes back to his disciples for comfort, and they're asleep. So he wakes them up. I think with a gentle rebuke, couldn't you watch just 1 hour? And then goes and prays some more, and they fall asleep again. So all of this time, Jesus is alone, physically speaking. We know that to this point, the Father's with him because he's still talking with him. But then Jesus announces, let's go on outside the garden, because to paraphrase, it's just about on us. It's going to happen now. So let's go out. And so they go out from the garden, and here comes this group of men with torches. This mob armed with sticks and staves and whatever light armament that they would bring with them. Interesting that they sent so many to arrest one man. But it's at this point that, as Jesus sees them approaching, really, as you read through this account, he's the one that's in control. He's the one who's in charge of the situation. We read that as they approached, Jesus asked them, whom are you seeking? They said, Jesus of Nazareth. He tells them, that's me. I'm he. And as we've discussed before, we shouldn't paraphrase that. You know, that's me. Jesus said, I am. That's the literal translation from the Greek. I am. In other words, he's agreeing with them. That's me. But we know what I am means. We know the weight that carries.
That's right.
And this is an unexpected response from someone that's on the verge of arrest. The group is not used to this. This guy calmly standing there, fully in control of his emotions. We know that after that second prayer, he was at ease. He had received comfort from God, because the cup is not going to be taken away. Jesus has gotten his answer. This is going to happen according to the will of the Father. Jesus is content with that. So from this point on, he is content. He goes forth in control of the situation. When he says, I am, they fall back on the ground.
Yep.
And then he asks them again, I ask you, who are you looking for? Jesus of Nazareth. I am. I've already told you. So since it's me you're looking for, let these other ones go. And that's when they flee. And Jesus is now completely physically alone. He doesn't even have them around him anymore. But as they approach him, I just want to read from Luke 22, beginning at verse 47. As I believe here, we see the compassion of Jesus, his love for lost souls, and a last-ditch effort to save someone. It says, while he was still speaking, behold, a multitude, and he who was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near to Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?